Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up today, if you're snarky and you know it, listen up. The woman behind two ultra-viral TED Talks shares research on the benefits of embracing vulnerability, even in the age of multi-platform criticism. Plus, the unexpected origins of today's ubiquitous infographic, how 19th century fascinations with statistics, cartography, and slavery propelled information into graphic form. But we begin with a 21st century investigation on the real-world effects of digital data. Every Google search, every saved photograph, stream song, text message, and each stroke of the email send button is served and stored on a digital infrastructure that is, to the end user, invisible. The New York Times has spent a year investigating the tens of thousands of data centers that support the information industry and discovered a secretive, power-intensive infrastructure sharply at odds with its sleek, environmentally friendly image. James Glanz is investigative reporter from the New York Times. He also holds a PhD in physics from Princeton, which must have been of great help in heading this investigation. James, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks. Yeah, it didn't hurt.
Yeah, no kidding. So what does one of these typical data centers look like? Would we know one if we saw it?
They're sort of hiding in plain sight. It's a strange thing when I started looking at this. It's an industry we all now rely on, but it's a very shy one. And you'll be driving down the road and you might see something that looks like a boxy warehouse with no windows. Sometimes you'll notice there's some diesel generators sitting outside with little smokestacks. That's a data center. Mm. And sometimes they're sort of secreted away in high rises and other spots, but often you just don't notice that they're there.
Well, shy is one word for it. You did find some companies quite secretive about locations and environmental violations. So how did you uncover this information?
One thing you couldn't do in this story is rely on your browser, because they're sort of invisible in their own medium. And so what I had to do was use old shoe leather reporting, go out into muddy fields and industrial parks and ask government agencies for paperwork on those generators and things like that. It was pretty much old-fashioned reporting.
Mm. Some really shocking statistics that you came up with in the report, including an independent analysis. This is by a Stanford research fellow, estimating that 2% of all electricity in the U.S. is going to data centers. That's 30 billion watts. Can you help us envision what 30 billion watts looks like?
Right. 30 billion watts is actually the worldwide value. In the United States, it's about a third to a quarter of that. But a nuclear power plant puts out about a billion watts. So you're talking about quite a lot of electricity. And an interesting thing about data centers, once they turn the computers on in the data center, they really never turn them off. So that's a constant load. It's on all the time, and it's drawing energy day and night.
So that is also, it sounds wasteful. I mean, isn't it kind of like letting your car idle?
It is. And the one of the main issues we came across in doing this is that the industry has just gotten in this habit of always having the computers at the ready in case there's an unexpected surge because of sort of historical reasons. In the early days, operating systems weren't as good, and people found that if you turned off a computer, it might not come back on. That's no longer true, but this industry just developed this habit of constantly having these things running, whether they're actually doing anything or not.
So what does that mean in terms of efficiency and pollution? That was the other thing that was uncovered in this investigation, a great deal of pollution.
On the efficiency side, it means that for a typical data center, and remember, there is a range of practices out there. So there are some companies that have adopted available technologies to reduce this waste, but for the most part, they have not. And what it means is that the useful computing that those computers are doing inside the data center, that computing is drawing usually around 10%, sometimes far less than that, of the energy that the data center is burning. The rest of it is essentially waste. On the pollution side, you know, there's two ways in which data centers pollute. One is that since they're drawing so much energy from the grid, so if it's coal-powered energy, then they're burning coal. If it's nuclear, it's nuclear. Other places, it's hydropower. What else you might be referring to is these generators that they have on site. They have banks of batteries and generators in case there is an interruption of power from the grid, mm-hmm. like a blackout. And then they run these generators. They're always there. They're huge. But they also have to test the generators. And so the diesel fumes from those generators is a source of pollution from the data centers.
So these are redundancies to make sure that things still work, even if there's a power failure. And that leads to the question of, isn't this just the cost of doing business? I mean, we, the users, have expectations of fast, anywhere access to our driving maps, our emails, our text messages. What role do we play in this expectation and this waste?
We're driving the whole thing, frankly. There are two sides of the coin here. One is the data center operators could be doing a much better job in terms of how they deal with that demand. But ultimately, what drives it is that we've become used to having 24/7 access to all these services with no delays, no limits in capacity. And so since a business knows that a user is going to become immediately irate if the user can't search at 2 in the morning for, you know, a nearby place to buy cheap sunglasses or whatever it is, they're paranoid about that, and they're fearful.
And not to mention the cost of disruption for, I can't imagine, you know, how much revenue Amazon generates in even an hour.
That is an issue for some businesses. I didn't put figures in, but you take Amazon or eBay or something like that, it's incredible how much money sort of passes through those data centers, at least figuratively, in very short periods of time. And so that's a huge business consideration for them.
Well, James Glantz, is it plausible then that we as consumers may one day be asked to go through our old emails and photos and baby videos and clean up our own digital junkyard in the same way that we might be asked to, say, cut back on watering our lawn during a drought or electricity during a brownout?
Yeah, I think that's a great observation. I think the trouble right now is that there's a sort of a, I don't know exactly what to call it, let's call it ignorance of convenience. On the consumer side, we really haven't wanted to think about that. And then on the side of the people providing these services, they haven't really wanted us to think about it either, because it's an uncomfortable subject. But I think that by raising this question, you know, I hope that companies and consumers will start to think about, well, what does this all mean? And is it true I can't keep this forever? And if I need to eliminate something, what should I eliminate and what impact would it have? We don't have that information yet.
Well, you really did peel back the curtain on that. I'm just wondering, you know, now when you hit the Google search button, are you thinking about this?
I am, yeah, and I get kidded about it a lot, too. Somebody wrote in, a reader, boy, if you're so concerned about this, why did you write such a long article? It's got to be on a server somewhere.
Well, James Glantz, thank you so much. It's a very revealing article indeed.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
James Glantz, an investigative reporter from the New York Times, and you'll find a link to the series that he really led on the environmental and real-world costs of big data. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. We'd love to know what you think as well. Should we be made more aware of our digital footprint and the physical mark that it leaves? Would that change your behavior? Do we expect too much of digital services, or is data storage all just part of the new economy and the process? Leave a comment on our Facebook page or send us a tweet. Stay with us for an antidote to the age that values cutting remarks and snarky tweets, daring to be insecure when word of mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Dr. Brené Brown is vulnerable. We all are. She's a researcher and author of several books. Her most recent, Daring Greatly, expands on themes she discussed in two TED Talks that have been viewed more than 7 million times. In a nutshell, it is by fully owning our vulnerability that we forge strong connections to others. And Dr. Brené Brown, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much. Good morning.
We live in a world where snark rules, where cutting remarks are the ones that get traction on Twitter, and sound bites that take another person down are considered successful. What place does vulnerability have in this world where snark rules?
I think the snark makes vulnerability much more difficult, but truthfully, I think, you know, as a qualitative researcher, I'm kind of on the ground talking to people about their lives and experiences, and I think we're snarked out. I think that we live in a culture today of very deep scarcity, a culture that's really informed by this idea of never enough. Never certain enough, safe enough, perfect enough, extraordinary enough, good enough. And I think one of the ways that we respond to scarcity is fear, and fear drives snark.
When you talk about scarcity, I think of all of the political campaigns and ads that we're seeing now, which are all about playing on fear and insecurity. It seems like that's the language of power on some level, making people feel as if they have a lot to fear.
My sense as a researcher is we are at the saturation level. We are so tired of being afraid. when I was, you know, writing the book, I came across the Roosevelt quote, you know, it's not the critic who counts. It's not the man who points at the strong man who stumbles. The credit goes to the man who's in the arena who, you know, to paraphrase, maybe getting his butt kicked, is winning occasionally, losing often, but always daring greatly. It took my breath away. I thought, this is everything I've ever learned about being vulnerable, you know, that we have this mythology that showing up and letting ourselves be seen is weakness, when in truth, it is courage. I mean, I think vulnerability is our best, most accurate measure of courage. I cannot find in 12 years of data a single incident of courage, moral courage, leadership courage, spiritual courage, you know, relationship courage, that was not absolutely birthed from sheer vulnerability.
It's interesting that you're talking about those examples, Brené, because those are all times when people would say, buck up, you know, put on a tough skin. Whatever the result of your mammogram, you're going to be strong enough to get through it. These are times when we are told to get stronger and put more armor on.
I would say be stronger, be courageous, reach out for support, hold space for the uncertainty. When I talked to interviewed people, CEOs, creatives who really were responsible for significant disruptive innovation, I would ask them, you know, what's the barrier? What gets in the way? And the answer consistently was people are afraid of being laughed at. People are afraid of being ridiculed. People are afraid of being judged. They can't stomach the vulnerability. And, you know, there is, in the absence of vulnerability, there is no innovation. There is no creativity. Yeah, vulnerability is scary. Yes, it's the center of things like grief and shame and fear and things we don't want to feel, but it's also the birthplace of love and empathy and trust. You know, to deeply love someone, to feel passionate about a cause is absolutely vulnerable because we're walking into total uncertainty.
I wonder if, you know, people sharing on Facebook, we talk about the sort of lack of privacy and people making their whole lives exposed. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that urge has to do with, you know, being publicly vulnerable.
One of the myths behind vulnerability is that it's letting it all hang out. And it's not. And vulnerability is really about sharing really intimate parts of our lives with people who've earned the right to hear them. I always say live tweeting your bikini wax or sharing intimate details of your divorce on Facebook, that's not vulnerability. But I do think the oversharing sometimes is a response to our desperation because we don't feel seen and heard. It's a lot easier to put something online and walk away than to pick up the phone and share something that's hard with someone.
You're talking about things in a human and a public sphere, and I think about work. Twice last week I was told by people, you need to grow a thicker skin. And I remember one of the first things that I was told when I was in management several years ago, that people mistake kindness for weakness. You're kind of on a mission to change that. How do you change it? Is this a person-by-person change? Is this a policy change? I mean, how does this work?
Mary Pfeiffer, who is just an incredible writer, she has a quote that says, change is a million individual acts of kindness. To me, I believe that we can start making changes when there's a critical mass making different choices. You know, in my work, I'm told all the time to grow a thick skin, but I'm not interested in a thick skin. The thick skin metaphor, it's really powerful because what it means is that if you say something that's hurtful to me, I can't feel it. But if you say something that's tender and important to me, I can't feel it either. When you get a thick skin, you get calluses on your feet, you don't get to wake up one morning and say, you know what, I don't really want them today. It's a much more courageous way to go to say, no, this is my skin, and I have feelings that can be hurt. I am very clear on my life about whose opinions of me matter. If you send me an email that said, read your book, cannot believe you forgot the entire piece of academic literature on this issue, I want to know that because maybe I forgot it. But if your job is a professional bleacher sitter and all you do is hurl criticism and judgment, I'm not interested. You know, I think we could avoid a whole lot of it if everyone was trying and everyone knew the vulnerability of putting themselves out there, of showing up and being seen. I think we would be a lot more mindful about what we said and did to other people.
Well, Dr. Brené Brown, I want to thank you for stepping into that arena today.
Thank you for having me on, and thanks for the work you're doing.
Dr. Brené Brown is a research professor at the University of Houston Graduate School of Social Work. She's also an author of several books, most recently Daring Greatly. You can find out more about her work and see links to her two TED Talks at wordofmouthradio.org. A replica of Bigfoot, a display case stocked with lake monsters, and the Mystery Cat Corner are a few of the attractions at the International Cryptozoology Museum in Portland, Maine. It's part weird science, a little bit sideshow, and the kind of place you might stumble upon while walking down a random alley. Lucky for us, intrepid producer Zach Nugent took that walk and brings us along on this audio field trip.
Okay, first of all, for those of you who don't have your mythical vocabulary down pat, cryptozoology is
the study of hidden or unknown animals. Cryptozoology is a method by which we look for physical evidence, folklore, sightings that may relate to proving that these animals actually exist out there.
That was museum director and founder and renowned cryptozoologist Lauren Coleman. He has always been fascinated by these hidden and unknown animals, which are known as cryptids.
I mean, I was the kind of guy during the 60s that would, if I saw a report that there was an ape-like creature in Mississippi, I'd hitchhike down there.
The way Lauren talks about cryptids is refreshing. You never get the feeling he's some crazy conspiracy theorist.
The two people that I don't like on expeditions with me are the true believers that come into it and everything they see is, you know, a big footprint or, that wave over there is the Loch Ness Monster. Or the debunkers who come into any kind of investigation with a totally closed mind.
Most people are already aware of the more famous cryptids, like the Loch Ness Monster, the Yeti, and the Bigfoot. But for people like Lauren, cryptozoology is much more than just the celebrity cryptids.
But at any one time, there's probably 200 searches around the world occurring looking for different cryptids. And so it encompasses all kinds of unknown animals.
Lauren takes offense when cryptozoology is portrayed as a science of things that don't exist, because sometimes cryptozoologists actually do find what they're looking for.
Today, I published a little article in my blog about a new toothless rat that was just discovered in the Indonesia area. So we have new animals being discovered all the time.
And over the centuries, many creatures that had been thought to be mythical have turned out to be real.
So for instance, the Kraken turned out to be the giant squid. The Bigfoot of Africa, in essence, was the mountain gorilla, which wasn't discovered until 1902. And the giant panda, which a lot of people take for granted as us having known for a long time. Well, the Chinese knew about it for a long time, hundreds of years. But it wasn't.
Okay, this is all well and good. But after seeing the 8-foot tall, 500 pound Bigfoot replica looming over the rest of the museum, well, I want to know more about Bigfoot. And although Lauren likes talking about all the other interesting creatures yet to be discovered in the world, I get the feeling he spends a lot of his time answering Bigfoot questions.
If I look at 100 cases of Bigfoot reports, probably 80 of them, 80%, are misidentifications, mistakes. Only 1% of the cases would be hoaxes. Those are usually the ones that the media talks about 95% of the time.
And the best evidence so far for Bigfoot comes to us in film. The Patterson-Gimlin film is famous in the cryptozoology world. A TV plays a loop of it in the museum. And when you watch it, you can't help but wonder.
The horses reacted because of the scent. That we know that there's over 350 years of native legends in that area. There was also footprints found. And so you get this combination of multiple layers of evidence. Really tells me that of all of the pieces of evidence for Bigfoot, the Patterson-Gimlin film is probably the best.
The museum attracts people from all over the world. When I was there, a few families wandered about getting their picture taken with Bigfoot and giggling about the fur-bearing trout. But they're not drinking the Kool-Aid. Although every once in a while, someone will come in whose passion for cryptozoology matches Lauren's. What do you think about this museum?
This museum gives evidence for the existence of these creatures without blatantly saying, this is absolute proof they exist. It doesn't believe in everything or willy-nilly, but it believes in the possibility of everything it represents.
And that possibility is what cryptozoology is all about. For Word of Mouth, I'm Zach Nugent.
Way up in the north woods and deep in the dark pine that blacken the mountains of the Cascade Range, they still tell the tales of an Indian legend. Sasquatch is the legend, Bigfoot is the name, the Indian.
Coming up, we may be living in the age of the infographic, but it's not a new tool. We'll hear about the 19th century origins of the modern infographic. We'll chart that evolution when Word of Mouth continues in just a moment.
Bigfoot is the name. You can ride from Canada to Northern California, all up and down the Cascade.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. I just Googled the age of infographics and came up with a number of articles and, of course, maps and charts declaring that we are living in it. Infographics are visual shorthand for data in the post-newspaper-slash-social-media-slash-soundbite age. At least that's what Google turned up. Several sources there credit the digital age for giving birth to infographics. Others cite the publication of USA Today's Snapshots, beginning in 1982. Susan Shulton begs to differ. She's chair of the History Department at the University of Denver and author of Mapping the Nation. Her recent feature for Fast Company called 11 of the Most Influential Infographics of the 19th Century raised our eyebrows. Susan, great to have you on Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So infographics in the 1800s, what kind of information was being put into graphic form then?
Well, I guess the first thing that I'd call your attention to are timelines, which actually precede the 19th century just a bit. In the mid-18th century, which would have been the mid-1700s, you've got two people, one in France and one in England, who are starting to put graphic measurement of time on chronology, so that chronology is represented by a line. And this, of course, becomes known as the timeline. Those begin to flourish in the 19th century, in part because of the rise of education, in part because of the advent of new and cheaper printing techniques. So timelines are the first to really flourish.
Today, the popularity of infographics may be due to the availability of data and interface tools for digital information. So what specifically came together in the 19th century that made that the time for graphically representing information?
I think there's a couple things at work. One is that to graphically represent information, you need information. And here I think there are two things going on. One is the rise of the census, which creates a larger and larger body of information that can be actually usefully put into graphic form. And that's also true with the natural world. If you think about the rise of observations about the landscape, about climate, about weather, all those things are aggregated information that increasingly needs to be organized. In other words, it really makes sense only to the extent that it can be organized visually. The other change I think that really makes a difference, as I said before, is the rise of new and cheaper printing techniques that make such experimentation with mapping data or graphically representing data much more possible for a wider audience.
Some of the earliest maps that we see are attempts to illustrate census data, and many of them driven by the social issue of slavery. We looked at several of these maps online at Fast Company and also on your website. We do have links to look at both at wordofmouthradio.org. And I'm thinking of one in particular, John Smith's infographic from 1888. Can you sort of describe that for us?
Yeah, that's an odd map. It's a really interesting one. The map you're referring to, if you can call it a map, is actually an interesting narrative map. That is to say, it's trying to tell a story. In the 1870s and early 1880s, the nation, of course, was celebrating its centennial birthday, and that became an occasion for lots of attempts to look back on the century and to put the nation's history into visual and graphic form. John Smith took that opportunity to make clear that the nation was very much bisected into two pieces. One was destined to lead in a kind of righteous way, that being the North. The rest was sort of, as he put it, cursed by slavery.
Right.
And that legacy continued.
The North actually said, the line there says, God's blessing liberty and then cursed by slavery. So even number-based, information based on numbers is not always free from a little bit of editorializing.
No, and in fact, all the maps that I look at, the maps, the graphics, everything is fully editorial.
You mentioned these being used as teaching tools. Now, there's an infographic from 1864, and I'm using the term infographic, the contemporary term, which illustrates the history of the United States and intended as a teaching tool. Can you explain this for us? This is Emma Willard's chronological plan.
Yes, or as she also called it very colloquially, her tree of time, where she's looking at the nation's history from the vantage point of 1860 and trying to represent it in an organic way through a tree. What I like about hers is that she's given the United States, or America, I should say, because she goes back to 1500, she's given it a kind of organic, holistic picture and divided it into parts. I think there are four parts at this point. But she's living through, of course, an unbelievable period of upheaval. And no sooner does she create this than, when she first creates it in 1860, than the nation descends into civil war.
We talked previously on this program with an historian about a comic in Puck that may well have brought down the Republican presidential candidate of 1884. And I guess it's important to see the power of visual imagery at this time, because so few Americans saw art or paintings or pictures. Is that part of the pull, the influence of these infographics at this time?
That's a great question. And I've thought about this because, as I said earlier, some of the earliest maps of slavery were drawn by the Republican Party for campaign purposes. They're very stark and they're very crude colored maps. They're very obviously propaganda, as we would call it. But it struck me that part of what they're trying to do is get their message out to a wider and wider audience that may or may not be literate or may have varying degrees of literacy. And while it might be complicated to talk about, you know, the drama of Dred Scott or the peril of expanding slavery, one map can really convey in very stark terms the threat that they're talking about. So I do think that in the 19th century, you have these rising levels of literacy, but you also have this new, forgive me, but mass medium, right? Newspapers had been around, but this ability to create atlases on a new scale, to issue textbooks on a new scale, all of which fuel the possibility that graphics might be reaching a wider audience.
And I think also influence a whole new way of thinking about information. I mean, is that what's going on here? People begin to sort of visualize things in a different way?
Well, this is something I spent a lot of time thinking about, particularly in the post-Civil War period when you see the explosion of statistical mapping. The head of the census tries to apply this kind of new form of sophisticated visualization of data on a wide scale to all aspects of the census. But what he realizes is that the people he's showing these maps to, the maps that integrate, for instance, more than one class of information, people aren't quite sure how to look at them. He has to sort of train their eye to look at the relationship between the two classes of data, for instance, shading as well as numbers. And so this is in some ways a new way of thinking about information. And as such, it creates new questions, right? What the head of the census liked was that he thought, well, if you put the census into visual form, that creates all kinds of new possibilities for asking questions about the distribution of the population.
Mm-hmm.
And things like not just the population, but wealth or literacy. If you can see the greatest areas of literacy, you can also see where they correlate to different immigrant groups, for instance, which is a particular concern that he had. But it's all about rendering the data in a spatial form.
Well, some historic gems being charted for us. Thank you so much today.
Thank you for having me.
Susan Shulton is chair of the History Department at the University of Denver and author of Mapping the Nation, which explores what she says is a period of tremendous creativity in American cartography. For links to the Fast Company article where we first saw some of these early graphics and more on her book, click on over to wordofmouthradio.org. And now Now we fast forward to 20th century interactive infographics. Last week, WNYC's John Keefe visited NHPR. He heads that station's new data news group and demonstrated some truly illuminating interactive data maps for us. One map of New York reveals that the blocks where the highest number of stop and frisk gun searches are conducted by the NYPD are not the places where stopping and frisking actually results in seizing a gun. So using graphics to illustrate raw data can add value to news stories or even become the story itself. John told us that most of the code that his data news team uses comes from CartoDB. That's an open source tool. Now, we were curious about CartoDB's other applications, so we went to their source. Javier De La Torre is CEO of Visuality. That's the New York and Madrid-based tech company behind CartoDB. And Javier is on the line with us from Madrid. Javier, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi.
So tell us a little bit more about these tools. What does CartoDB provide?
It's a software that works on the internet. It's a website where you can go and you can upload your data or someone else's data. You made this example with the New York Police Stop and Frisk data set. And what you can do with CartoDB is that you can go to the New York Police website. You can grab their files, their data sets. You can upload them to CartoDB, and then you can create maps. Maps that will show you, for example, where do they stop more people, and do maps of where do they stop more black people, mm-hmm. or where do they stop more white people. So you can do this type of analysis, and you can then share it on the same way that you would search something like a YouTube video.
Right, so it's interactive. You can actually put your mouse over these blocks that are the darkest purple, meaning they have the most stops, and it actually tells you how many stops are done there in a year. You know, that's one of the things that journalists have often been tasked with doing, especially investigative journalists. They spend hours and hours going through reams and reams and reams of numbers. This work that you are doing at CartoDB saves that work and actually makes it easier to interpret for audiences. Did you develop this specifically for journalists?
No, we didn't really develop it for journalists. We didn't have journalists in mind when we were working on CartoDB. The main use that we were targeting when we created CartoDB, it was environmental issues. So if you think about things like global environmental change, like global warming, or you think about like biodiversity and species getting lost, I mean, all these topics are very, very attached to location. So most of these issues, you have to represent them on maps. So we created CartoDB to help scientists analyze and visualize their data about the environment. And it was kind of like curious that when we released CartoDB as an open source tool, we started getting journalists talking to us and saying us, well, this is a great tool mm-hmm. to actually do our work in finding the stories on data sets that are in the interest of journalists. And so what happened is that suddenly there was this community of what we call now data journalists that are like investigating on these data sets. They came to us and they started asking for features. I'd say right now probably the main community of users of CartoDB are actually journalists. But it's kind of curious that we were not envisioning that when we created. So,
what's the most fun CartoDB application? You know, the craziest, funnest map you've ever seen made?
Well, there is an application developed by a group in New York that I quite like. It's called A Scene Near Me. So the cool thing about this project is that it imported the database from New York about where movies have been recorded. And what it does is that when someone do a check-in on Foursquare, they actually check what movies have been recorded around you. Say that you are in a bar in the center of New York, I don't know, in Times Square, and you just check in there, and it tells you, you get a message, and it says, and they're like, hey, did you know, like, Ghostbusters was filmed close to here? And that can provide a lot of funny conversations when you are out there with your friends. That's been quite funny.
Javier, I want to thank you so much for your time.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Javier De La Torres is CEO of Visuality. That's the company behind CartoDB, an open-source interactive mapping software used by journalists and a lot of others, including our friends at WNYC in New York. We have links to see some of the infographics that we mentioned today and others, including the link between television show preferences and viewers' political preferences, a calculator for figuring out the cost of your college alma mater, if you were attending today. You can also explore A Scene Near Me. All of that is at wordofmouthradio.org.
I ain't afraid of no ghosts. I ain't afraid of no ghosts.
And coming up, what went on in the real Downton Abbey? We'll hear about a Portsmouth woman who married an English aristocrat and lived a life that became part of the inspiration for the hit BBC drama. And Word of Mouth will continue with Pinky Up after a short break.
Word of mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Come war and peace, Downton still stands, and the crawl is still in it.
Nothing succeeds like excess.
You have given me back my life.
Scenes from the third season of Downton Abbey. No shortage of drama there, which Britons are already watching. And here's something to keep American audiences from wringing their hands until PBS airs the popular drama in January. New Hampshire has a peculiar link to the masterpiece classic. The story comes alive in a new exhibit at the Portsmouth Athenaeum. Downton Abbey, The Portsmouth Connection, profiles the life of Catherine Wendell and the Castle Highclere. That's the grand county estate where Downton Abbey is actually filmed and where events which inspired the program actually took place. Ronan Donahue is curator of the exhibit, and he spent ages cataloging more than 80 boxes of photographs and correspondence donated to the Athenaeum by the Wendell family. And he's joining us now with more. Ronan, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Catherine Wendell, born in Kittery, Maine. How did this woman end up living in an English castle?
Interesting story. She was born in Kittery, Maine because her grandfather had a house in Kittery. He was a major in the Marine Corps and was stationed at the Navy Yard. Mother must have been visiting the family home when she gave birth in 1900 to young Catherine. Catherine and family lived most of the year in Manhattan. They had a rather handsome house on East 35th Street, visited Portsmouth in the summers to visit Wendell family at a magnificent summer home in Newcastle, right out on the beach. And in 1911, her father, who had been a successful businessman, suddenly died. And the mother took their four children and went off to live in England, where a first cousin had previously married a wealthy Englishman and gone to live. And they all lived together at St. Albans.
Mm-hmm. And so this woman apparently met an earl?
The present countess has written a book about her predecessors. And when it comes to Catherine, she says that Lord Carnarvon ran into Catherine first in Gibraltar, a rather brief meeting, seems to have been very taken by her. And then they meet again when she's traveling with her mother in Istanbul, very exotic. And by the time they leave Istanbul, they apparently have decided to marry. His family isn't too happy about it because she doesn't have much money.
Mm-hmm.
There's money, enough money to support the family in England with nobody working, and the boys going to Eton and Oxford, and the girls being brought up sufficiently well to marry earls, both of them, but not enough money to run Highclere.
From letters and photographs, do you get an impression of what kind of young woman Catherine was?
You do. I haven't seen a lot of letters from Catherine. I get a lot of letters from all the rest of the family talking about Catherine.
Uh-huh.
But she's rather delicate. People talk a lot about her nerves. She eventually, later in life, becomes a Roman Catholic, and everybody says, oh, I think it's probably good for Catherine. I think she needs that stability. So I gather a rather delicate woman.
Well, you kindly sent us a few of these letters in advance, and we asked one of NHPR's reporters to read one for us. Now, this is Amanda Loader, our colleague, reading excerpts from a letter by Mary to Edith. What are they, cousins or?
They're sisters.
Oh, sisters. Okay, let's hear.
Dearest E, your letter of August 2nd and your lovely parcel both arrived yesterday. I can't thank you enough. If you could possibly know the excitement of getting perfume. It is marvelous, and I went to London to meet with Pen and G, smelling too divine. Catherine Catherine has had kind of a nervous collapse and been in a home, and Aunt Em had a sudden canker on her tongue, and they whipped her off to a home and thought it might be cancer. But it isn't. No other news. I am picking apples hard. Millions of plums and no one wants them. And we had very little sugar for making jam. Endless love, M. P.S. We went to say goodbye to Miles. It is a real godsend that Mabel is dead.
You get the delightful language and then the little bomb at the bottom of it. Well, do we get, I mean, you know, obviously we get a little of the high Clara lifestyle, the prim and proper. Do we get to know what's really going on inside of that home?
Yes, we get to know what's really going on inside the family. We don't get to know what's going on downstairs. But Mary, our faithful correspondent, tells us an awful lot about what's going on upstairs. You said at the beginning, you spent an age with going through these records at the beginning. It did take an age. It was mostly because Mary wrote such marvelous letters. Mm-hmm. We would run around the Athenaeum reading them to each other. Wait till you hear this and what she says about this and what she says about that. You just couldn't read them silently to yourself. They had to be shared with everybody else.
Now, some of the letters that you sent us also detail life at High Clare during World War II. Here is another excerpt from a separate correspondence between Mary and Edith. Let's hear it.
I dread the winter and the horrible blackout and the crawling about in the dark and the short days, etc., etc. When the war is over, I shall turn on every light in the house and open every window wide just to lean out and enjoy it. Oh, how I want it to be over. How the Germans can possibly stand the bombing, I can't imagine. I wish you could hear the noise of them passing on their way over. It is like 20 express trains. Well, I'll pop this off. Again, 1,000,000,000 thanks. I wear your blue dress all the time. It is perfect and not worn a bit. Endless love to you all. M.
Oh, a very moving letter.
Many of them are.
Yeah.
I hope many of your listeners will come and visit the exhibit because there are photographs of Mary and she looks exactly the way she should look. If Maggie Smith looks exactly the way the Dowager Countess should look,
Mary is Mary.
Some of your listeners will remember Mrs. Miniver. Mary actually went out to her tennis court and took under arrest and drove to the police station a German airman who had parachuted out of his plane before it crashed, which is one of the memorable scenes in Mrs. Miniver.
Wow, I thought one of the plot lines on, Downton Abbey were a little far-fetched, but that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Now, Ronan, why do you think we are so fascinated? I mean, you loved looking at these letters and discovering this woman, Catherine Wendell, life so removed from our own. Why are listeners and why are visitors to the Athenaeum so captivated by this?
I think because, as with celebrities, we're all the same. And you don't have to look very long before you realize that there's a great similarity. The lives aren't really all that different. And it's delightful to find that although the surroundings are so different, the financial situation is so different, that the people are pretty much the same and that you can identify with them. But in this case, I think the acting and the writing is so superb. The people easily get wrapped up in the story of Downton Abbey.
Well, I have to tell people that although we have to wait until January, I am one of those people, doesn't mind spoilers, and reads ahead on The Guardian UK. Ronan, I want to thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks very much, Virginia.
Ronan Donahue is a retired history teacher. He's curator of Downton Abbey, the Portsmouth Connection, which runs until December 1st. Really, go and take a look for yourself. And special thanks to Amanda Loader, who helped bring the voices alive on this segment. You can find more on the third season of Downton Abbey and the exhibit at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for your attention and listening time today. We will be back next week to land on more conversations and curiosities unconstrained by space and time. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is served to you by the Baronet Taylor Quimby, First Footman Zach Nugent, Her Ladyship Virginia Prescott, and the Master of the Horse, Rebecca Lavoie, with support on the web Scullery from Sarah Plourd, Esquire's Andrew Perella helping us with the Telegraph, and Dan Colgan as Manager of the Household. The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. For information about the show, to obtain a Victrola disc or to post a letter, go to wordofmouthradio.org, whatever that is. You can also join a community of listeners on something called the Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio or on the Twitter phone at Word of Mouth. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.